You took his land and you ate his corn. And on his grave your land was born. You took his pride and you fed him dirt. You wished him winter without a shirt. And you called this red man savage. And after you crushed him, you helped him up to let him drink from an empty cup. You gave him the navy without the fleet and made him lick your hands and kiss your feet. And you named this mad dog savage. Well, I found a book the other day, so I looked up red and white to see what it'd say. One was a savage, the other unlearned. Like a look in the mirror, the tables were turned. For history has named you savage.
Hello, my name is Mark Clyde Houle. I'm an Ojibwe from the Turtle Mountains of the Dakotas. And today you'll be hearing the third in a series of tapes which are being produced by the Center for Communication and Development through a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today we'll be continuing a discussion on Indians in the media. Today an interview with the Standing Rock Sioux, Mine Deloria.
Standing Rock Sioux Indian from South Dakota, and I've been active in the Indian community nationally, at least, for 15 years or so. I was once executive director of National Congress American Indians, and in 1970, I founded a group called the Institute for Development of Indian Law, which is now, I've left them almost a year now. But they're working in the field of tribal government training. And I've been to Minneapolis a number of times. I think last time, for any length, was during the Means Banks trial. I was expert witness in that trial. And since then, I've been working in the Wounded Knee cases.
Through this series of shows that we've been doing, we've been taking a look at some Indian views and Indians' opinions that have been expressed from within our community in Minneapolis. And we took a look way back into the 50s and the early 60s and the situation that it was then and how it is today. What are your feelings on the situation? Do you see any changes made within the society in favor of Indian people?
Well, it's difficult to tell. There's certainly been a lot more awareness because of Alcatraz and Wounded Knee. But if you look back, say, the whole century, there seems to be kind of a sporadic interest in Indians about every 20 years, and always seems to take pretty much the same course that we've seen, with the exception of the militancy of the 60s and early 70s. I think it's kind of a different course. But insofar as Indian jewelry, suddenly there's an interest in that. There's a book on the Plains Indian Wars. People get all excited and want to contribute money to Indians. I think you can see about every 20 years this coming to fruition. So it's very difficult to assess what the impact of the last few years has been when placed in the perspective of a century. But I certainly think there are a number of handles that you can attempt to use to try and bring that situation in some kind of manageable form. And maybe the best thing to look at is how the media itself has changed the American public in their perception of what problems are. And because, say, 20 years ago in the 40s, there's tremendous concern about starving Navajos, and there were commissions going out to find out about Indians. But the media was an entirely different thing in those days. And I think What we really see today is a concentration on the more spectacular things. If they're not spectacular, then they really don't have very little relationship to the media as a means of communication. And consequently, I think a lot of good Indian things have been lost that you simply can't do with those type of media that are experiences in communities. So in that sense, I don't think the American public or the Indian community has really recognized what we're dealing with, and we may not for another 5 years.
When you speak of media, do you speak of radio, television, and print media, or?
Primarily television, but print media insofar as you're talking about newspapers. I think one phenomenon that I've seen in the last 4 or 5 years is that the newspapers and magazines will rush in to discover what's going on with Indians, but they've not really made opportunities available for younger Indians or even Indians in age categories 30 to 45 to come in and really learn what that media is. Mm-hmm. As most of the articles being written on Indians at the present time in 1977 are once again written by non-Indians. And there was a period, I suppose, 69 to about 73, when most of the articles on Indians were done by Indians. There's still Indian writers around. There are a lot of young Indians coming up doing short stories and poetry. But it almost like the media came, touched, and exploited Indians, and then moved on. And Indians trying to get in the media and really understand it, I think, are back on the outside now.
You think the media overplayed Wounded Knee?
I think it's overplayed a great many things. Down at the Cedar Rapids trial, where they had these two Indians indicted for the murder of the FBI men, some of the evidence there looked at what pictures were printed in the newspaper and what the original photos were. And there were a lot of crop photos that appeared in newspapers that would make it look like Indians were more violent than they were. And that was introduced in evidence to show that the media, in many areas, was making a bigger and more violent, spectacular event out of what was going on than what was actually happening.
What was happening at Wounded Knee?
I think it's very difficult to assess that because there's so many forces that are kind of pulling people who were involved with that off what was the center focus of the protest, which just seemed to be absolute frustration. And in pulling people off, then different people give different interpretations. And I was completely baffled for the first 3 weeks because if you read it in the New York Times, it seemed like protest was one thing. If you saw it on television, it was another. And I think Indian people not yet learned to grapple with those kinds of things. And so we have to take a very close look at what is available in communication forms and then start to really pick what form we want to use and how we want to do it.
Do you think if the media had not gotten involved in Wounded Knee and with the situation being just very low-key, not played up much in the radio or the television as they did or the newspaper, do you think the situation or how the finals, the end of the Wounded Knee, and what happened there, do you think the outcome would have been different?
Again, that's hard to assess. There might have been a lot of people killed if you hadn't had the cameras trained on the government to keep the government in line. On the other hand, it might not have become such a big event from the very beginning. And there might have been some negotiability there. But the major element in Wounded Knee is the paranoia of the White House. And the number of the Nixon tapes have been subpoenaed in trials coming out of Wounded Knee to find out exactly what was going on. There's a suspicion that Wounded Knee was allowed to develop and was made over spectacular because at that point Nixon was trying to get out of Watergate. Uh-huh. And so he needed big events to cover up Watergate. And so the Indians come along, and of course this thing's blown up. So we don't have enough information to say just what the role of the media was there, because there's that additional dimension of manipulation of all parties by the federal government.
The center that I work for, one of their goals or one of their purposes is to present images of minority people in a more positive fashion. How do you think the Indian community could go about using the media to present ourselves in a more positive fashion? Or do you think we should use it at all?
Well, I'm undecided about that, but I'll tell you what I think one of the major problems is in attempting to use the media, and that is American people know very little about their own history. And if you start bringing up historical situations, a great many of them reject the truth because they have not been taught that it was that way. They've been taught something entirely different. That's the reason we have this tremendous emotionalism over the Maine Indians. Maine Indians won a lawsuit based on a federal statute that said you can't sell their land without Congress approving it. Right. Now, if the American public knew American history, they would know that was one of the first acts of the United States Congress, and it's the law of the land. You see, in communicating to the general public, there's always an assumption by Indian people that the non-Indians know as much about their own history as we do, that when we talk about religion, that they really understand the dimension of religion. And when we talk about land, that they understand land in terms more comprehensive than something that you wave a paper deed and say, this is my land. And I think we should use the media, but we have to recognize that the majority of our effort really should go at the highest levels of thinking in an attempt to bring non-Indian thinkers into a broader perspective. And that's extremely difficult because there aren't that many people in this society that think to begin with. And so it's a task of searching out that one guy in 100 who's willing to consider alternative views and alternative explanations.
Last summer, I think it was, or last winter it was, I'm sorry, I attended a conference, Indians in the Media, up in Bemidji State College. And the people that attended that conference were attempting to interest Indian youth in the media. And there's about 40 kids there, and there appeared to be just a total lack of interest in the media. Now, I know that because you're a writer, you're involved in the print media. I've gotten involved in some sort of media with this broadcasting. How do you think we would go about interesting our youth in the media?
Well, first, I think we have to grapple with substantial things in whatever media we deal with. And that becomes very difficult because in the print media and in television, you're dealing with the lowest denominator of public interest. So you can write an absolutely lousy book on Indians that has no historical basis whatsoever and sell a million copies because you've written it in an exciting style. You write a fairly accurate history, and it doesn't have to be a heavy history, but fairly accurate. And you're getting a reduction in the number of people that will actually be affected by it. So I think maybe our first task is to really look at the ineptitude of the media at the present time. I mean, how many people does the media in its best activities actually reach? And you find the print media reaches very few people. A bestseller today is something that sells 50,000 books, but there are 214 million people in the United States. So you're not even talking about 1% of the people for a good book. So I think then you have to look regionally at what are the regions that can be dealt with. How do you distribute not simply books? How do you tape radio programs that are going to reach people in certain areas? How do you create television that's going to have an important impact on the immediate area? And as you begin working that, then you're starting to bring adaptations of different media to very particular groups of people. And I think that's one of the processes we've got to start. And so I think the Indian task at that point then becomes one of understanding the technical aspect of media.
Once we got to that point, how do you think that we could use the media as a form of educating non-Indians about Indians?
Well, I think what really has to be done in that respect is to find topics that transcend both Indians and non-Indians. water pollution, air pollution, education, in any, you almost pick any topic, juvenile delinquency. But then that Indians should make a presentation of what they really think the boundaries of that situation are and how you control it. If you take juvenile delinquency, we should really get traditional Indians to talk about the Indian way of bringing up children and enter into full discussions with non-Indians about the way they bring up children. And I think you'll find you'll be able to highlight two different points of view. The Indian is a very informal, very human way of dealing. The old people deal with the younger. In the non-Indian world, you create these institutions over here with all the IBM cards and the files, and you run psychological tests, and you treat the child as if it were a machine, and then your job is to take a monkey wrench and go tighten certain nuts and bolts. When you get the kid tight enough, he's supposed to work. And that's how you cure juvenile delinquency. So in the future, I think in presenting Indian problems, we've got to present human problems and then get two perspectives on those. So that there's debate and dialogue going back and forth.
You think that would be the first step then in the right direction?
Well, I think it's a transitional step. One of the things that really blocks Indians from communication is non-Indians do not perceive that we have a common history with them. Our history for non-Indians starts at 1492. There's got to be some way to close the gap of conception. How do people conceive us to be? When we can close that, then I think that we can move in there. And that requires talking continually with very thoughtful people in bringing our own culture together so it can be presented as a consistent whole.
Do you think that American Indians are losing their culture?
No, I think the culture is transforming in fundamental ways. That you still have patterns of behavior that you can look back in old documents 150 years ago and you find a certain pattern of behavior. You go to an Indian meeting today, you find the same pattern of behavior. But all this technology's come along too. So you find Indians have kind of transformed that behavior and they're now using different things to do it. You go to a reservation, almost everybody has an unlisted telephone number. So what do? You have to go into the different families on the reservation. If you get a telephone number from one of them, you can call a great many people there. Now that's your old family band structure still there. But what they've done is taken the unlisted telephone number and made that the hookup, see, instead of the camp circle. So I think it requires a lot of insight, and that's been my complaint for 15 years about social scientists. They don't look at Indians the way they are. They still got the reservations, saying, how did the horse affect you? Well, we're not talking about horses today. We're talking about Hondas and pickups and campers. And once you can get the non-Indian world to see that transition, the Indian kids at Pine Ridge treat Hondas the way they used to treat ponies 100 years ago. You know, they're going all over those gullies and just having themselves a time. And you got to point out to the Indians, you haven't lost your culture. What you've had are behavior patterns you've allowed to transfer over. You're doing the same thing Indians are doing, but you're doing it faster, and you're doing it in far different ways. Look at tape recorders and cassettes at powwows. Everybody goes around, and they're taping everything goes on at powwows.
That's true.
Well, that's the same as in the old times. You go visit a tribe, you hear a song you like, you remember the song, you take it back to your tribe and say, hey, I heard this new song, I want to teach it to you.
Yeah, there's quite a few non-Indian people that really have a distorted view on powwows. That's essentially brought that up. I was going to ask you, what do you think about alternative education and alternative education teaching Indian youth?
Well, let's say in the next 30 years, it's going to be the form of education. What has been traditional education is going to vanish. You get taxpayer revolts that refuse to let you buy more buildings. Your school administrations are top-heavy with administrators who keep charge of records. There are lawsuits right now of non-Indians suing their own school district because in all this expenditure, they couldn't even teach them to read in 12 years. So I think it's not just Indians are going into survival education. It's large groups of people are just going to have to go that way because the other system doesn't make sense. The system for keeping children in a building for 12 years. It has nothing to do with education anymore. In alternative schools, where you're teaching people what life is like plus what the streets are like. I think that's the way it's going, and it, larger and larger groups of people are going to go that way until the present system collapses.
You see that as a good change?
Oh, sure. There's no doubt about it. Because who ever heard of teaching philosophy or religion or literature or history by putting people in a square building and having them sit at little desks? The majority of human societies in human history have had old people sitting there in a marketplace with younger people saying, "Grandpa, tell us how what happened," and then he tells them what happened. If you look at the American educational system in terms of the historic experiences of our species, it's insane. It's absolutely insane. It should be done away with as quickly as possible.
Are you saying this about the total educational system?
Total educational college? System from kindergarten all the way up. It gets more insane the further up you go. There's no reason today why an Indian student wanting to get a PhD in history on a subject in the American West should have to take French and German. And that, those requirements go way back when rich Americans thought they were cultured if they knew how to talk obscenely in French. And you see, all those requirements are still hanging on to us. Now, how much better if you could talk Navajo and Dakota or Spanish? You know, something that deals with your subject matter. But when you get to grad school, you're really talking about organized insanity right straight down the line.
Some people talk about the day when they'd like to see an Indian college it'll be a traditional type Indian college. Do you have any feelings on that?
I think you could do it right now. I think the Mohawks, with this traveling college, the Iroquois have, they've gone a long way toward that. But I wouldn't like to see buildings put up and Indians in letter sweaters carrying briefcases and things going on. That's absurd.
I'm not familiar with this Iroquois Traveling College. What would this be?
Ernie Benedict, the Mohawk up in Canada, has this. He calls it Traveling College, and what he does is stop at Indian communities and spend a couple days and tells them some of the legends that they've forgotten and goes over just about anything on Iroquois history. He's the Indian version of a Renaissance man. What I'd really like to see happen in education is just informal community or neighborhood meetings where you can just everybody sit down and be comfortable, have a cup of coffee and some donuts, and then different people get up and give a fairly accurate rendition of some part of Indian culture that people are interested in. If you get a whole group of people doing that, you could have a national university where you're really getting into things. I'm trying to do that in a little way by trying to start a cassette course on Indian treaties for the Indian prisoners in South Dakota Penitentiary.
Treaties, that's interesting. What do you think of the Indian treaties, the treaties that have not been honored yet?
Well, you have to break down very carefully. I think there are about 20 major treaties with major articles that have yet to go to court and are going to be very explosive and very controversial. Almost half the treaties that were signed were really peace and friendship treaties. They didn't do much for either side. There are almost 500 unratified treaties, some of which the government claims that they acquired land under, but then they've refused to pay the Indians any benefits. Those are going to have to come up in very difficult situations. But again, the whole treaty problem is that non-Indians don't know American history, they don't understand American law. They think if they don't like a law, then it's their job to go out and violate it, which is contrary to everything the American government stands for.
How could we educate? How could we educate non-Indians on what it's like to be an Indian?
I think that's the most difficult situation of all, and I really question whether that can be done. I think if we can just teach some of them to think, get them away from authority figures, get them away from instant responding to code words. If you look at the way Nixon operated, all he ever did was shout code words, and people responded. They were just like a group of trained dogs. And what we've got to do is have a great deal more communication with non-Indians and try and get their minds loosened up so that when people say treaty, they don't have a spasm. And this is what American educational system should have been doing but never has. This is what churches should have been doing but never have done.
Indian people, the media, and education. When Indian people speak amongst themselves about the need to share our culture and our values with non-Indian people, almost always the term electronic media comes up. And immediately afterwards, the question arises, how do we best utilize that form of the media? And perhaps unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we still only speak amongst ourselves about the term electronic media. To erase the stereotyped image in some people's minds that they have of Indians is a very large task as we see it, and whether or not the electronic media will help still remains to be seen. These productions have attempted only to make you aware that we as Indian people see a need to share our culture and our values with you. And up to this point, unfortunately, at times the media has prevented this from taking place. I'm Mark Clyde Houle. I'd like to thank you for joining us.
Little is really known about the American Indian, or what links their human soul with the earth. The Indians believed that this land was created for them by the Great Spirit, and that it would be theirs forever. The New World, this is what the white man called our land. But it was not new at all. The red man, inhabitants of America for centuries.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent those of the Minnesota Humanities Commission or the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Natural as